Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over 140 million U.S. families are impoverished or low income, according to the Poor People's Campaign. But many in the media can't seem to figure out why more people are not celebrating the stock market setting a new record, which just happened, or the overall state of the economy. In the new book, Going for Broke, Living on the Edge in the World's Richest Country, co-edited by today's guest, Alyssa Court, writers share stories about what it's like to live without a stable social safety net as they deal with issues like finding a mental health provider on Medicaid, caregiving, trying to find a job with an invisible disability, and surviving on the streets. With so much attention on the state of the economy, what will it take to ensure these stories get the coverage they deserve, especially during an election year? Alyssa Court is executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. It was created in 2012 to support the work of journalists telling stories that dispel negative narratives and put a real face on the people struggling to make ends meet. They've been placing stories in mainstream outlets for the past decade. A piece Alyssa Court wrote for the Washington Post about the overturning of Roe and her difficult pregnancy is in the book Going for Broke. Alyssa Court is also author of four previous nonfiction books, including Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America, and two books of poetry, most recently Thoughts and Prayers. Hi, Alyssa. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Oh, thank you, Rose. It's always great to be here.
Great to have you back. We're also joined by Deborah Jian Lee. Deborah contributed to Going for Broke. She's also senior editor at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, a radio producer, and author of Rescuing Jesus, How People of Color, Women, and Queer Christians Are Reclaiming Evangelicalism. Hi, Deborah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Well, it's great to have both of you. I just want to ask you both about what's happening with the media around economic coverage. CNN had a panel recently, and they were so excited about the stock market setting a new record. And one of the panelists said, so why aren't more people excited about this? And someone said, well, that's the million-dollar question. And yet you hardly hear these stats about over 140 million families in this country who are impoverished or low income. So Alyssa, what are your thoughts about all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're not talking about the majority of Americans that are either kind of doing retail work or manual labor or lower level white collar work, because 8 in 10 consumers earn less than $50,000 a year and they can't cover their bills until their next paycheck. So they're not exactly investing in Apple, right? And they're also not spending wildly on exorbitant luxuries. And even when you go higher up the income chain, 4 in 10 of higher income households earn more than $100,000 are also living paycheck to paycheck, according to a study. So we're just, I think there's a real blindness about how most Americans live. When you look at the cost of food has gone up much faster than other sectors, and that's what everybody spends on. But people are also spending on housing and healthcare and paying down their school debt. And these are the people who write for our collection that we're here to discuss. But also more recently, we had a writer named Lauren Krauss, who wrote for Huffington Post this week, I was trapped in a soul-crushing corporate job for one reason, and that reason was so she could afford her monthly medication. Mm. So this is really what America looks like. I call it the middle precariat. That's middle class plus precarious plus proletariat. Mm. And that most of us who are so-called middle class are in this unstable space where we're not able to invest in the stock market.
Deborah, I mean, this is such a great time for the media to really focus on these issues, given that we're in an election year. I mean, you've got politicians and their supporters on NPR every day and on TV regularly. And yet the real story here, everything you all lay out in the book and really what you do at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, is just often missing from these conversations. Why do you think that's the case?
Yeah, I think we need to look at the fact that the stock market doesn't benefit Americans evenly. You know, stock ownership is heavily skewed towards the ultra wealthy. So middle and working class Americans aren't popping champagne bottles because their stake in the market is so much substantially smaller. People care about the rental market, not the stock market, not the stock market. On paper, wages have gone up a little bit under Biden, but adjusted for inflation, they've gone down. And it's just hard to care about the stock market when your paycheck has hardly budged and your rent has shot up 20%. So I think, you know, for the journalists that we're working with, like, it's really crucial that journalists look at the economy not through the lens of Wall Street, but through the lens of everyday Americans. And that's what we're doing in this anthology. Like you mentioned, we're trying to illuminate what it is like for Americans trying to survive in an economy where the cost of living is outpacing wage growth and they're forced to sell plasma or blood or couch surf, or they're struggling to get mental health care, or they're going broke as family caretakers, or they're facing employment discrimination because of an invisible disability.
Deborah, to your point, it took me 1 second to find on Yahoo Finance that the top 10% of Americans held 93% of all stocks last year, the highest level ever recorded. And yet that wasn't on the CNN panel when they were celebrating the stock market. So I wonder, Deborah, we should let listeners know that you work with these writers who write about their story of struggle or someone else that they've interviewed. And you place these stories in such a wide array of publications. I was just reading the piece that just got placed in the New York Times called A Life Without a Home by Lori Teresa Yearwood. You also get pieces placed in Elle Magazine. I mean, such a wide range of publications. So we're not just talking about independent. Of course, those are great, but you have a wide range here, sometimes women's magazines. Deborah, what do you hear from editors when you pitch these pieces about people struggling to make ends meet?
I think there is a hunger to hear about what people are going through across the country. And I think what we're doing at EHRP is really trying to create this pipeline to get independent journalists a platform where their voices can be heard, like you said, not just by, independent outlets, but by mainstream publications who may not have the resources, or may not be as focused on issues of economic inequality. And I think what's important to understand is that this issue of economic inequality, it cuts across all parts of our society. It's adjunct professors, it's caretakers, it's single moms, it's families, it's people, students, young people who are overburdened with student debt. And I think that's what editors are seeing when they're working with us, that we are able to work on stories that reach the audiences that they're trying to reach and really drive at the concerns that their readers are dealing with every day.
Alyssa, what would you add? What changes have you heard from editors over the years? And what strikes you about the responses you get when you pitch these stories?
Well, it's been really interesting because I've been doing this a long time. You know, I started this with Barbara Ehrenreich, the late, great Barbara Ehrenreich. And when we used to go to really mainstream places, they'd say, oh, we don't want to co-publish. You're an advocacy organization. But I think one of the paradoxes of the media business being in free fall is people are now really eager to have partnerships. So that's actually been a real net positive for us, at least, that people are open to working with organizations, nonprofits. There's no stigma to it. But I also think people understand that these pieces get hits. You know, they're not just medicinal for the reader. The reader sees themselves sometimes in these works, especially when they're about things like debt or, being a contingent professor or a school teacher that has to drive Ubers. These are the readers. So I think that is one of the things that struck editors. Like they actually come to us now and ask us for the voices of our writers because they understand people want to read about these experiences and people see themselves in these experiences.
Hmm. Well, if you have a story to share about your economic situation, we'd love to hear from you. And what do you think about what you're hearing in the media about how the economy is booming, and yet so many reporters are always saying, well, why isn't this resonating with voters? But the statistics, we just don't hear those important statistics, or bring on someone who's struggling to make ends meet. So if you'd like to join us and talk about your economic situation, what you think about media coverage of the economy and inequality, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Alyssa Court is Executive Director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, which she founded with, as she says, the late, great Barbara Ehrenreich. And she's co-editor of the book Going for Broke. Deborah Gian Lee contributed to Going for Broke, and she's senior editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. So, Alyssa, before we dive in and talk about the essays in the book, they're so good. Talk about how this came together. How did you make these choices to put all of these essays in Going for Broke?
Well, yeah, I mean, this was the work that we've been doing for 10 years. So I had in my head kind of just memories of what some of the strongest pieces were. They include Darrell Wellington's account of having to sell his plasma that we then co-published, because EHRP co-publishes, we then co-published with The Atlantic. And he is, what has been for 2 years, the poet laureate of Santa Fe. And yet, he lives on $30,000 a year, and at some points he's had to sell his plasma. Why did we do it? Partially because we wanted to platform these voices. I think there is something different about having people in a book. A book feels like something that's going to stay for a long time, but who knows, given culture's rapid shifts. But for now, it feels more permanent than articles. And many of our contributors, being precarious middle class or working class or unhoused, you know, they haven't appeared in books before. And so part of what I wanted to do was sort of show, yes, this stuff is literature. It's journalism, but it's also literature, and it's worth our time. A lot of it's quite beautiful. And I also wanted to have it structured in a certain way. So I started with a section called The Body. And the reason I did that was, this was after Dobbs. And I felt like we need to have a physical understanding of how the body intersects with inequality in terms of disability and in terms of unwanted pregnancies and in terms of reproductive rights and pregnancy itself. So that was part of what I wanted. I wanted a really embodied understanding of inequality in that. And then, you know, went from there. There's four other sections, and each section has a wonderful introduction by, you know, cult favorites, Michelle T, or Astra Taylor, and other people, Kianga, who's a writer for a New Yorker.
Right, Kianga Yamada Taylor. That was a really interesting one, because I know her work, but I didn't know much about her background and growing up struggling and moving from house to house. Deborah, I think that's what makes this so powerful is, you know, writers, like poets, Princeton professors. I mean, so many people sharing their personal story. You might think, oh, this guy writes for The Atlantic or Vanity Fair, he must be doing really well. And yet you learn that he's driving for Uber or donating plasma. I mean, that's where we are right now. So can you talk about the power of writers sharing their stories about struggle to let people know that this actually is pretty common? You just don't hear about it as much as you should.
Yeah, I think what we're doing here is really giving people space to give readers an intimate look into their lives and their journeys through economic precarity. And I think about Alex Miller as one example. He's an EHRP fellow, and he published this piece with EHRP in Newsweek that offered this intimate look into the challenges he faced as an unhoused veteran. Now, on paper, you know, Alex has been published all over the place, the major national media outlets, Esquire, Fast Company, The Daily Beast. And you may not know the whole backstory. And so his story really, really opens that up to the reader and shows that the struggle of a millennial U.S. Navy veteran and what it was like trying to rebuild his life after his service ended.
This was such a powerful essay. This piece was published in Newsweek, and it's printed in Going for Broke. Alex Miller writes about how he served as a U.S. Navy IT specialist in 2006 off the coast of Somalia. 2 years later, he was homeless, standing in line in Gainesville, Florida, twisted around the block so he could donate blood in exchange for $20. He says, many of the men waiting with me looked almost as bad as I did. All of us homeless and hungry. My hair was matted, crusted from dandruff, and my eyes were bloodshot. My fingers tingled because of withdrawal from the anti-anxiety medications I wasn't getting from the VA. Between childhood trauma and my 4 years in the service, I relied on medications such as Zoloft for PTSD, but the VA delivered my meds through the mail, and I hadn't had a stable home for some time. With no permanent address, my meds never found me. The other thing I appreciate about these pieces, Deborah, is almost all of them include facts about how this is affecting so many people. As Alex Miller writes, sadly, my situation was far from unique. On a single night in January 2020, 37,252 veterans were victims of homelessness. And the VA processes about 80% of veteran prescriptions by mail. So when a vet loses their home, they often lose access to their medications their life depends on. I mean, just to think about, these numbers are massive and these people are not getting their meds. This is such an important story.
Yeah, and it's something that, you know, journalists, they've written about veteran homelessness in the past, but Alex brought both his journalistic chops and the authority and intimacy that only someone who has walked in his shoes can bring. And I think through his essay, he was really able to shine a light on the gaping holes in the safety net that our nation's veterans face. So I was really moved by his piece, and we've been able to work with him, bring him on as an EHRP fellow. He's won prizes for the essays that he's written. He has bylines in Esquire and Fast Company and the Daily Beast, and he's featured in the anthology and also our Going for Broke podcast, and he speaks regularly at EHRP events. So it's really wonderful just to see the life cycle of someone who contributes to EHRP, who can tell their story in such an intimate, detailed manner, and then go on to just reach multiple platforms and get this message out there, because so many people see themselves in Alex's story. And then there are so many people who don't know these details and can gain greater empathy and understanding of what someone like Alex is going through.
Yeah. And toward the end of the piece, he writes, I'm in a better place these days. I haven't been homeless in years. I recently moved into a new apartment and I've carved out a nice writing career, but I'm still healing. With the pandemic, access to mental health continues to be a struggle. It's such an important and beautiful piece. Alyssa, there are several pieces about veterans in this book.
Oh, absolutely. And that, I guess I have a proclivity for assigning around that, partially because my husband's a war correspondent, and I can see what happens with when PTSD from the forever wars meets up with economic insecurity in this country. And so sort of like, this is a fatal brew, really, that's under-examined. And it's part of, you know, something that we've been actually thinking about at EHRP, creating trauma therapy for some of our reporters and potentially other reporters in the industry, because of these kind of things, because of the intersection of economic instability and even desperation among independent reporters, and then their experiences they've led, including things like having been veterans or having reported on the opioid epidemic and having been traumatized by the deaths of sources and you know, suicides from deaths of despair they've witnessed. Nowadays, domestic reporting looks a little like war reporting, covering sedition and uprisings and riots and so forth. So I think I'd really like to see more of that. I'd like to see more trauma care. And the first step, I think, is to illuminate what that is like to have been traumatized and then to try to be a writer on top of it and to tell your story.
Alyssa Court is co-editor of Going for Broke. It is a new book. So many stories in this book, writers talk about what it's like to live without a stable social safety net. Alyssa Court is executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. They support the work of journalists and writers who tell their stories about what it's like to make ends meet. They write about inequality, and a number of the stories that they have gotten published in a wide range of media outlets are now in this book, Going for Broke. Deborah Jian Lee contributed to Going for Broke. We'll talk about her piece, and as well as the person she wrote about, Andrea Wagner, who's going to join us after the break. Deborah is senior editor at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, and you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Lawrence in Berkeley. Hi, Lawrence. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Great show. But I did want to say that if you're serious about poverty, you have to talk about the organizations that are going to fight it, that will make a difference. And those are of two kinds. There's, first of all, unions. And there's, second of all, organizations in neighborhoods that do mutual aid for each other, and also politics. And, you know, at various times, we have had organizations that have gotten both of these together. And that's especially important now, because 80% of the American workforce is in what they call service employment. That means nurses, people in hospitals, people in schools, people in stores, people in cafes. And the difference between this kind of employment situation that we have now and the ones that unions mostly think of, which is the 30s, is that unlike a factory or a farm or a mine, the people in service industries are in day-to-day contact with the community. And therefore, they have to join with the community in order to get anywhere, which is a wonderful opportunity, but it's not being done very much. It means that if you have a store, you can organize the workers, but that's not enough, because they can fire the workers and still the store will go on and they can get new people. But they can't fire the customers.
Well, thank you for your comment, Lawrence. I just want to add here, we do have some news that is very exciting. I don't know if you've been following this, Alyssa and Deborah, but hotel workers in Los Angeles have been striking and demonstrating for months. I mean, we're talking about very expensive hotels, $1,200 a night in some cases. And it was just announced, I'm reading from CBS, after months of demonstrations, these workers ratified a landmark contract securing a 40 to 50% raise. This is going to affect 10,000 members at 53 hotels. We're going to do a show about this to get more information, but they're getting a $10 an hour raise. Now, of course, we have to say that they've been paid very low for really hard work. But a $10 an hour raise, and then a lot of them say that they can actually plan for the future because they're going to have pensions. So that's a huge story that deserves more attention. And Alyssa, I know that you've been doing a lot of work on mutual aid, which we'll talk about in a minute, but this kind of organizing is going on across the country right now.
Yeah, it completely is. And I want to thank the caller for calling in. We've been doing a lot of work around covering unions. We have a collaborative piece in Mother Jones, 8 photographers going around the country shooting different aspects of the new unions that are cropping up. But the whole point of the piece was to look at the paradox that the caller was mentioning. You know, in 2022, even as the popularity of unions got to a generational high, the people actually enrolled in unions were 10%, the lowest on record. So that is the paradox, that we're seeing a ton of new kinds of unions and, you know, unions for like hotel workers, Starbucks, Amazon, also white collar, you know, university professors, magazines and publishing. But then you're also seeing fewer people in unions. So that's the sort of paradox that we have to keep in our heads at the same time. And obviously we at ERP heavily support unions, but we also indeed support mutual aid. And one of the things that interested me was when I was started looking, thinking about the media layoffs, I was looking into the media mutual aids that have started. So there's one in Los Angeles for the Los Angeles Times that has raised quite a bit and distributed the money. And then there's a historical one from 2 years ago from Gannett, which has is a chain with 200 people, and they have these very brutal layoffs. And they created a mutual aid around the Gannett layoffs 2 years ago, and people did incredible things. They sent direct aid via Venmo, including cash for things as specific as like Journalist Daily, insulin, childcare, rent. They connected laid off people with employment lawyers who could look into their severance agreements. They researched unemployment benefits in reporters' states. So even in the media itself, which as we were talking about is in free fall, we're seeing mutual aids having a positive effect. And they definitely are having it in lots of other areas, which I actually have written about considerably. But yeah, that's just to start with. And also one thing that's been interesting to me is some of these mutual aids have offered moral support. So it's not just money. In the Gannett mutual aid, they also sent notes to people who were laid off talking about how great their old reporting was. Wouldn't everybody like to get those notes? Starbucks gift cards, things like that. So, I mean, mutual aids can also do things that are psychological and build solidarity and build strength of purpose, as well as give people who are in need money and food.
Well, thanks again for the comments, Lawrence. We'll take more of your calls after a break. We're speaking with Alyssa Court, Executive Director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project and co-editor of Going for Broke, Living on the Edge in the World's Richest Economy. Deborah Gian Lee contributed to Going for Broke. She's also senior editor at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. This morning, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a case that will determine whether the abortion pill mifepristone remains legal. We will speak with Crystal Littlejohn and Ricky Solinger about their new book, Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade. We'll also be joined by Ansev Duramarn with True North Research, who looks at the anti-abortion groups behind the case and does a really great job of following the money. Of course, it's traced right to Leonard Leo. We hope you can join us for that show tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation, we're talking about the new book, Going for Broke, Living on the Edge in the World's Richest Country, co-edited by Alyssa Court. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We're also joined today by Deborah Gian Lee. She contributed to Going for Broke, and she's a senior editor at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Why don't we take another caller who's been waiting patiently, and then we'll introduce our next guest. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. I am a part of the safety net. We're on the safety net. And it's ludicrous to call it a safety net. I'm disabled. I'm on SSI. My monthly income is less than $1,200 a month. Because I live in subsidized housing, I'm able to survive barely, because more than half of my income goes to pay my homeowner's dues. I can say for a fact that at least in Palo Alto, food costs have just skyrocketed here. And I don't know how people, and I'm on Medicare and Medi-Cal, which are not the greatest safety net health programs. To say it's difficult would be putting it mildly, to just try and get by. I will also say this. I mean, anybody who's on less than the safety net is in miserable shape in this country. I think the people who are on this part of what they call the safety net is in pretty bad shape. It's really unfortunate. Well, unfortunate's not the right word, but it's terrible what the politicians are doing with regard to this. Want to cut, cut the income from SSI, et cetera, et cetera. I've dealt with Social Security's bureaucracies that manage this stuff. It is really onerous. to say the least, to deal with these people. I don't know. They seem to think it's their money. It seems. So it's difficult. It's getting much harder to even survive on this so-called safety net. So, like I said, there are millions of people on it, and I think they're just barely getting by. So thanks.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Greg. And we're definitely going to do a show about Social Security. The House, of course, their GOP plan would cut Social Security. And we'll definitely do shows about that in the coming weeks. Thank you, Greg, for calling in. And now we would like to welcome Andrea Wagner to the show. Andrea told her story about what it's like to be legally blind to Deborah Gian Lee for the book Going for Broke. The piece, My Disability is My Superpower, If Only Employers Could See It That Way, was published in Elle magazine. Hi, Andrea. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and thank you for sharing your story with all of us. Can you tell us, first off, how you connected with Deborah and why you decided to share your story?
Well, funny story. I'm actually a self-acclaimed aspiring independent journalist, and I saw a call for pitches on Twitter, well, X now, but it was Twitter then, and at that moment, I had never heard of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, and so I was like, look, all they can say is no at this point, but I want to say what they were asking for was captivating, because if I'm not mistaken, it was about people in the job market or the difficulty of finding a job, despite what was being actually reported in the media about like America's unemployment numbers. And so I decided to shoot my shot, if you will. And they wrote back and were immediately interested in me telling the story. And at this point, I guess you could say I was in the disability closet, if you will. By that, I mean I had never been that vocal outside of family and friends and people that needed to know. So, like teachers when I was in undergrad and grad school, I only told people who needed to know. There are still people, despite the ongoing, I guess, opportunity to share my story, there are people who still have no idea. And so I decided to just get out of my way, because I know I'm not the only person impacted by, I guess, this, I don't want to say life sentence, but this life trajectory. And so I just wanted to spread awareness.
I think your story is so important, Andrea, because like you say, so many people out there have invisible disabilities. As you write, I'm disabled, but not disabled enough. So can you give us a couple of examples of what your experience has been like to be legally blind so people don't know that you have a disability? I mean, you've got these such interesting stories about trying to get a job and you didn't make enough eye contact and you found out that's why you didn't get the job. It's something that a lot of people don't even think about, and that's what makes your story so powerful.
Thank you so much. Well, for starters, I will say that I was beyond resistant. I don't think resistant is a powerful enough word to describe how I initially took on having retinitis pigmentosa and consequently being legally blind. I apologize. My 8-month-old co-host wants to tell this story. Until I was about 28, I'm 33 now, I exclusively wore, well, once I started wearing contacts, I exclusively wore contact lenses because I didn't want to wear glasses. I do not have a cane, nor do I even know how to use a white cane properly, or like a sighted guide or a seeing eye dog or any of those things that would, I guess, be a telltale sign to having a visual impairment. So literally no one knew. Unless they had to know, because I've always participated in, like in high school, I was a cheerleader. I was a drum major. I've worked up until now, which I guess we'll get to that part as well, since I was 15 years old. And so I tried to hide it, for lack of a better term. But, and I, while I'm extremely versed in the laws provided by the EEOC and the Americans with Disabilities Act, and I know that companies have this beautifully printed verbiage on their website about being inclusive and wanting to hire people with disabilities, I don't exactly fit that category. There are millions of people in the United States with disabilities, according to the Center for Disease Control, but people that are blind or visually impaired or low vision, however they decide to categorize themselves, are often the most likely to be unemployed and receive, like what the caller was describing earlier, a safety net, quote unquote, of disability services from Social Security. Well, most of those people do not have a bachelor's and master's degree, and I have both. And so there are companies like Walmart and Goodwill specifically that promote hiring practices for people with disabilities, but they are visible disabilities. So you can't look at me and tell I have a disability. That's why I mean about having an invisible disability. And that's also what I mean about not being disabled enough, because people don't think about, oh, a 33-year-old can be disabled. I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa when I was 5. So most of the time in the eye doctors and other places that are designed to cater to people with disabilities, I was the youngest person in there by a long shot. And so if you think about even the jobs that are offered for people with disabilities, like being a greeter in a store or a cashier, most of them are older people. And there are organizations that hire people with intellectual disabilities. But then again, when you come to me with the visual impairment and the advanced degrees, it makes this plight of wanting to have a different life for myself and now my family, it makes it even harder, like finding a needle in a haystack. And if it's okay with you, Rose, I don't mind reading an excerpt to give the listeners a better insight on exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes, please.
Okay. So in March 2019, I was giving a presentation for a job at tutoring services at the University of Alabama. I'm sorry, at a university in Alabama. What the 5-person hiring committee saw was a petite black woman dressed sharply in a crisp shift dress and a tweed blazer, standing in the front of the room. What I saw, mostly darkness through my eyes, very narrow, peering down a, like, okay, for my vision, it's like looking through a paper towel roll. You can just say I have permanent tunnel vision. Mm-hmm. I could make out the small conference room and the multiracial panel of interviewers, of men and women, smiling directly at me, but they did not know about my retinitis pigmentosa, a genetic disorder that gives me permanent tunnel vision. As a black woman with an invisible disability, I was used to this. Like, no one ever knew. And so, consequently, I end up not getting the job, but I knew a woman on the interview panel who told me that I gave an excellent presentation. I was very knowledgeable about what it needed, like the skills needed to be a successful academic coach in tutoring services at the time, but I did not give proper eye contact. So they were afraid I wouldn't be personable enough to the students. But like I said, they did not know that giving proper eye contact is not really something I can do.
That one really got me, Andrea. You write, one panelist dinged me for lack of eye contact, and that was the deal breaker. That's just so frustrating. I mean, what can you do about that? I mean, write them and let them know what's going on?
Well, I guess the struggle, what can I do is, right, at this point, seemingly nothing, but just hope that someone will, I guess, see me as a person instead of just some demographic box to check. Like, oh, we hired a Black person, we hired a woman, we hired a person with a disability. Mm-hmm. Because I often am afraid to disclose whether or not I have a disability, even down to applying. So I'm often left out of the conversation before it even starts. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, with the current attack on the field I was working in, diversity, equity, and inclusion, it makes it even harder.
Well, and as you point out, only 25% of disabled people with advanced degrees are employed. And the jobs that do reach out to people with disabilities, like to be a greeter, for example, are low wage jobs. And
right.
They don't help you go to the next level or help you pay off your school debt.
Absolutely not. And so I find myself in an inevitable rat race, if you will.
Andrea, what was it like to have your story published in Elle magazine? What sort of response did you get from sharing your story?
Well, I'm still getting responses. Some of my associates and even friends and some family members had no idea. To the level that I guess this vision or lack thereof, how limiting it is. But I'm beyond grateful for that opportunity because it led to an NPR interview, which led to this. Like, I'm still having the opportunity to tell my story. And while I know that this negatively impacts me on a daily basis, I know I'm not alone. But I also know that no one knows this because it's not talked about. I mean, October is White Cane Awareness Month. And then, of course, there's National Disability Employment Awareness Month. But those are just 2 months of the year. This is my life and other people's lives 365 days a year, or 366 this year. So it was beyond powerful. And I would say it was like, it's exactly what I needed. Since that moment, every time I get these opportunities, even on a rainy, stormy day with me and a fussy 8-month-old, I look forward to these opportunities to shed light on my story, to just hopefully allow some employers or politicians or lobbyists or someone with actual power to know that this is not okay. I do want to work. I actually enjoy working. I love advocacy work. And so when the story was published in Elle, it just gave me a feeling I've never had before. Like, I know that this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I know I'm supposed to tell this story. Mm-hmm. And so I just, while I hate the why this story is happening, I know the power of it. Mm-hmm.
Andrea Wagner told her story about what it's like to be legally blind to Deborah Jian Lee. And her story, "My Disability Is My Superpower, If Only Employers Could See It That Way," was published in Elle magazine. Andrea says, in the eyes of employers and public service providers, I'm disabled, but not disabled enough. Deborah, can you jump in here and talk about what it was like to interview Andrea and then to hear her say that, I mean, this piece was published in Elle June 2021, and she's still hearing from people about it. It just speaks to the power of telling your story and really the power of getting these pieces in major media outlets and a range of outlets.
Yeah, thanks, Rose. And thanks, Andrea, for sharing. Honestly, I'm so moved just hearing about how the story has impacted your life. And I feel like it's such an honor to have played a part in helping you get the story out into the world. You know, this is what we're doing at EHRP. We're really trying to give these really fresh perspectives on how economic inequality really runs the gamut. We're trying to show the spectrum of economic inequality in America and how it doesn't always look the way you might assume. And working with Andrea was really powerful because we talked a lot about her experiences and just the nuances of all the ways that the safety net, there are holes in the safety net, and she slips through them because she doesn't qualify, you know, according to some, you know, government prescription and standard. And it's really made us at EHRP think more about how we define disability and how we talk about disability. Mm-hmm. Because I think in a lot of ways, these invisible disabilities, you know, they go unseen, they go unconsidered. And we're missing out on a lot of the stories that need to be told. And we need to shine a light on how people like Andrea are affected by our policies and by our society, because we want to include them. We want Andrea's talents. You know, she has multiple advanced degrees. She has this rich life experience and deep empathy that can reach, you know, students and whoever she's working with in the DEI field. And she can really create more inclusive environments for people and make society better. We should be bending over backwards to make sure that she stays in the conversation and that her talents are being used for the rest of society. So, you know, it was really wonderful working with Andrea, and it's really moving to hear how this work has continue to speak to people in her life and beyond.
Alyssa, what would you like to add when you think about the power of Andrea telling her story, still hearing from readers 3 years later, and then doing interviews about this, probably touching a lot of people? Maybe employers might be looking at applicants in a different way now because of Andrea's story.
Oh, we really hope so. Thanks for bringing that up. And also, I mean, this is something we hear about a lot. I mean, people have started GoFundMes for the subjects of our stories, multiple GoFundMes for the subjects of our stories. A story I wrote for us years ago, the subject of it then was offered like a bicycle for her disabled son due to it. And that was just the one I knew personally, but there's ones in which people were unhoused and they, were able to pay their rent for a couple of years based on articles we've run. So that's just the palpable kind of concrete help that this provides. But there's also, you know, the impact one hopes of getting these voices out there, amplifying them. We say that we're media for, by, and about people struggling with financial instability. So that is makes us really unique in the field. We're really the only nonprofit newsroom devoted to inequality. Mm. And I think also of another contributor, the famous reporter Ray Suarez, who, he wrote for us because it was an essay called That Sinking Feeling, because he was unable to pay his dental bills. And you think of him as somebody who was a host on NPR and Al Jazeera and PBS and is basically a celebrity, but he had aged out, or that was his reading at least, of being able to get media jobs. He writes in our collection, "I have to scratch together the dough for my property tax, my homeowner's insurance, and my monthly premium. I'll keep an eye on the calendar and cross the line to Medicare, as so many friends have begun to do. One thing I don't ask is, why me? Given my age, given the numbers, given the realities of work in America for those who are displaced, I could well ask, why not me?" Mm. And I think that's the connection we're hoping to make. It's like, these aren't marginal people who are unlike the reader. This is who the reader will eventually be. We'll all eventually experience disability if we live long enough, you know?
Right.
So,
yeah, and we invited Ray. Unfortunately, he couldn't join us today, but we definitely want to have him on a future show to talk about his experience, and probably so many of you listening, what it's like to try to make ends meet as you age and try to find a job. There's just so many stories here. We got an email from Eileen who says, "People often look at those who don't have a high income as lazy or just enjoying a life without working hard, when the opposite is true. Not having enough money to pay the bills is stressful. Working two or three jobs is stressful. Not being able to find a job is stressful. Working hard for a pittance is stressful. How to unionize the unconnected doing Uber or TaskRabbit work." Thank you for that, Eileen. A couple other stories that we didn't have time to get to, but again, I'd love to do more shows about this. Medicaid has been good to my body, but it's abandoned my brain, by Katie Prout, a staff writer for the Chicago Reader, writing about how hard it's been to find mental health care on Medicaid. Ah, that one really is such a great piece. Another one, The Underground Economy of Unpaid Care, by Julie Poole, about her mom who's a caregiver. Different stories, but the connections are so similar, that this, that the economy is just not working for so many people in this country. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but Andrea, I just wanted to give you the final word. Can you just talk about, you know, why it's so important to tell these stories and the ripple effects, given the experience that you've had? And we have about a minute left.
Thank you. I will do this the best, the fast as I can. But it's imperative that these stories are told, because they've been muted for so long. If I'm a historian by trade and training, but people didn't know that FDR was disabled, because America thought it'd be a bad look if they knew the leader of this country had a disability. And so it is time to, it's time to stand up and be heard, despite what it is looking like with the attacks against DEI and all of the things, because if we are silent, we will continue to be silenced. So, I mean, we're already mistreated, so might as well make some noise.
Andrea Wagner told her story about what it's like to be legally blind to Deborah Jean Lee. Her story, "My Disability is My Superpower, If Only Employers Could See It That Way," is in the book Going for Broke, Living on the Edge in the World's Richest Country. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us. And we'd love to have you back to talk more about your work with DEI and all of the attacks that we're seeing in places like Florida and Texas.
And Alabama.
Well,
I love that.
Thank you so much. And I hope you can check out the book, because Andrea has an amazing story about meeting her partner and what she's doing right now. Deborah Jean Lee contributed to Going for Broke. She's senior editor at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Alyssa Court is executive director of the project and co-editor of Going for Broke. Deborah and Alyssa, thank you so much for your great work. And thank you for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And you can find more about the book and the stories that we talked about today at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.